Okay, let's get going on our next panel. The title of our next panel is Mountains to Mounds, the Vanishing Snowpack. I have to tell you that some of my colleagues at the PUC did not like that title. And if any of you do not like that title, you can blame me. I like the title, so there you have it. I think it does say a lot, and it is a... even though I have a joking tone in my voice, it is serious business about the vanishing snowpack. And so today we have a very distinguished panel, and to lead that off is our moderator, Jared Huffman. Jared Huffman is Assemblymember Huffman. He is a member of the California State Assembly. He represents the area just north of San Francisco in Marin and Sonoma. He is in his first term, and in his first term, he is chairing the Environmental Safety and Toxic Materials Committee, which has jurisdiction over the California EPA, air pollution, making Assemblymember Huffman one of the key legislators who will be involved in overseeing California's new global warming law, Assembly Bill 32. Mr. Huffman also serves on the Assembly Water, Parks, and Wildlife Committee, and in that role we'll be addressing the many water challenges confronting the state this year in that very capacity. Prior to his election to the California Assembly, Jared served as a senior attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council, or as we know it as NRDC. And he was an elected member of the Marin Municipal Water District Board of Directors for 12 years. At NRDC, he was involved and, in fact, was instrumental in negotiating what is called the San Joaquin River Settlement, an agreement that is moving to restore a 153-mile stretch of the San Joaquin River in our Central Valley. We believe this will be successful, and as such will be one of the largest river restoration projects in the nation's history. Please join me in welcoming one of our new California Assembly members, Jared Huffman.
Well, thank you, Susan, and welcome to all of you. The worst fear of any water manager is, of course, running out of water. And I learned a little bit about that kind of fear from my 12 years as a board member on the Marin Municipal Water District. As Susan mentioned, Marin County is just north of here. For those of you from out of town, it's a bucolic area, and the water district serves about 230,000 people in central and southern Marin. It's an agency that almost ran out of water in the 1976-1977 drought. And despite major investments since then, in imported supplemental water supply, in conservation, and in water recycling. The fact is, Marin, for the last 7 years, has been operating at a water supply deficit. Thankfully, for almost all of that period, we've had above-average rainfall. But if the drought of 1976-1977 occurred today, Marin residents, despite all of the demand hardening from their investments in ultra-low-flow toilets and plumbing facilities and drip irrigation systems and other efficiency measures, would have to reduce demand an additional 70% in order to keep from running out of water. The choices facing Marin, like many water districts in the West, are not easy, and they are certainly not cheap. I think you're going to find a common thread through the panel that you're about to hear, is that the era of easy and cheap solutions to providing a future water supply is over. Consider the fact that MMWD is currently funding conservation incentive programs that pencil out in the range of $800 an acre foot. Conservation incentive programs at $800 an acre foot. If any of you are paying more than that for incentive programs, I would love to know, but I think that probably is setting the pace. The district is also considering a small desalination plant on San Francisco Bay to diversify its water supply portfolio and to provide a hedge against our region's volatile precipitation patterns, patterns that are likely to get even more volatile with climate change. Yes, it's expensive, but how do you value wet water in a critical drought? And is the drought of 1976-1977 really the drought scenario that we should be planning for? California's water management challenges are compounded by the fact that our environment and our fisheries desperately need water, too. My work at NRDC over the past 6 years taught me that most California rivers and streams need more water right now in order to support healthy fisheries and ecosystems. In Marin's case, one of the victims of poor water supply planning would be Lagunitas Creek, a beautiful North Coast stream which, in addition to providing most of Marin County's water supply, sustains the largest remaining population of endangered coho salmon in California. If Marin does not address its water supply deficit, water managers and regulators in the next drought may very well have to choose between the thirst of 230,000 people and the continued existence of this vital fishery. We face the specter of these choices on an even grander scale with our largest and most important estuary, the Bay Delta, which is in ecological collapse due in part to the record level of water diversions over the last decade. We know that the Delta's low-lying lands and fragile levee system means that in any number of disaster scenarios, we're going to lose water diversion and conveyance facilities, and the Delta may even be rendered useless by even a moderate rise in sea level. And yet today, the future water plan for California relies on increased diversions from the Bay Delta. In light of all of this, we ask, how should water managers best respond to the threat of global warming? My first hope is that being the forward-thinking folks that you are, water managers would get on the front edge of the fight against global warming. You're not Bush administration scientists. Nobody will stop you from talking about the importance of preventing global warming. However, that's not what this panel is about. This panel invites us into a very unsettling way of framing the discussion for those of us that are steeped in the fight against global warming. We are assuming in this panel that global warming is inevitable, and we are focusing entirely on how to respond to its impacts. This is a discussion that we absolutely must have because we're in a race against time. As we know, we're already feeling some of the impacts from global warming, and things are going to get worse before they get better. So even as we join the fight against global warming, it's the job of water managers to plan for the worst, to plan for disasters, and that's what we're here to talk about today. Among the questions this panel will address, what impacts are water managers most concerned about? What adaptations will be necessary? What modeling and other analyses are they doing or do they plan to do? And what additional information do they need to be able to make informed decisions about the future? Our discussion takes place against a political backdrop here in California where leaders in both parties have recognized the importance of including global warming in our water supply planning and investment strategies. As you know, the governor's water proposal calls for $4.5 billion in order to partially fund two new surface storage projects, Sites Reservoir north of the Delta and Temperance Flat Dam near Fresno on the upper San Joaquin River. Together, these projects would provide about 500,000 acre-feet of additional water supply, but they're also being promoted as tools to provide flood protection and operational flexibility to hedge against hydrologic changes due to global warming. Meanwhile, Senate Democrats in California have unveiled an alternative water package, which likewise targets the need for better flood protection, more water supply, but does not include new dams. The Senate package emphasizes conservation, groundwater storage, reoperation of existing reservoirs, and improved floodplain management, and it is being promised as a cheaper and faster way to address the problem. So with these high stakes hanging in the balance, we're blessed today to have a world-class panel of water managers, the folks who make the tough calls and the high-stakes planning decisions for some of the largest water agencies on the Pacific Coast. Our panel, in the order that you're going to hear them, includes Chuck Clark, the director of Seattle Public Utilities, Edward Campbell, the director of Resource Protection and Planning for the Portland Water Bureau, Maureen Stapleton, the general manager of the San Diego County Water Authority, Lester Snow, the director of California's Department of Water Resources, and Wally Bishop, the general manager at the Contra Costa Water District. Each panelists will have about 10 minutes to speak, and I will ask the panelists to remember that the 10-minute time limit is a little bit like global warming. It sneaks up on you, and then it's hard to deal with there at the end. So we'll try to stay on time, and then we'll try to reserve 30 minutes for questions and answers at the end. Thanks.
Thank you, Jared, and I will go through this very quickly, and I hope there are sufficient teasers in there that it may get you to ask some questions as we get near the end. Some cautionary notes. This is the City of Seattle system. It is not your system. So the aspects of our system are a little bit different. I think you ought to look at some of the principles of what we're doing, maybe not some of the specifics, and see if those same principles can apply to some of the work that you're doing on the planning side, the design side, the modeling side, the adaptive side. I'll talk just briefly for a couple seconds about the mayor's initiative on climate change in general, because it's given us a political environment within which to work, and then get into the specifics of the Seattle system. Go ahead. As many of you may know, the mayor of the City of Seattle, Mayor Greg Nichols, has adopted the Kyoto Protocols for the city and has started a process with a lot of other mayors in the country to try to figure out a way to start more aggressively dealing with climate change. If you're interested, you can, at the bottom, we have the website where there was an advisory commission made up of a number of corporate entities, including Starbucks, Boeing, and a number of others that got together with the public sector and came up with a plan for the City of Seattle. The materials are there. If you're interested, I'd encourage you to go ahead and take a look at those and see some of the things that are being done with other mayors across the country. Next. Our system, we have two water supply sources, basically. The Cedar system, which provides about two-thirds of our water supply, and the Tolt system, which provides about one-third of our water supply. We own the entire headwaters of the Cedar system, all 90,000 acres. We control that, and it is secure, so it allows us to not filter that supply. And the Tolt system, we own 15,000 acres around the headwaters. So we own the majority of our, control the majority of our system, and which gives us a little bit of flexibility in the way we design and manage our systems. And it allows us to do some experimenting with our systems that we couldn't do in other areas. Go ahead. Again, 90,000 acres. Most of our reservoir in the Cedar system gets about 100 inches of precipitation a year. We are a heavily rain-dependent, precipitation-dependent water supply. We don't have multi-year storage, and so we depend primarily on precipitation, either as snow or as rain. Next. Go ahead. For us, there's a number of adaptive strategies that we've been trying to figure out how to invest in to start dealing with the consequences of climate change. One of the first is really trying to figure out how to get rid of as much uncertainty as we can. We know we can't get rid of the uncertainty related to climate change, but are there other things that maybe historically weren't cost-effective to try to minimize uncertainty, but we can start minimizing now so that future water managers aren't going to deal with those as one of the uncertainties in their portfolio? They'll hopefully be more limited to just dealing with the uncertainty related to climate change. What does that include? It includes things like, in the last year, we've settled a 50-year debate with the Muckleshoot Indian tribe that cost us about $40 million and set minimum flows in the Cedar River in perpetuity to deal both with fish needs and with water needs. So we took an issue that's been sitting in the courts, and we took that off of the uncertainty side and made it have a certain relationship with them. We're reexamining for the Cedar system, even though it is unfiltered now, whether we ought to go back and do filtration, not from the sense of a quality standpoint, but 2 to 3 to 4 weeks a year, we divert water around our plant because of the level of sediments in there. Can we invest and give the operator of the system the ability not to have to divert that water so that in the future, as an operator of the system, they have more surety on what they're going to be able to do to manage the system? You ought to be pulling apart your systems to see that person that has to make those decisions every day, what can you provide them for tools to provide more certainty. We have temporary pumping stations if the water got low enough in the Cedar system to get floated out on the reservoir. We're now looking at investing in permanent pumping station. If you float things out on a reservoir, it takes you about 4 to 6 weeks lead time. If you have a permanent pumping station, it takes you 24 hours. An issue that 10 years ago we wouldn't have thought was that important, now we're looking again, how do we give the operator the flexibility of responding to 24 hours to results of operating the system. We've updated the entire SCADA system, the entire information system, to try to go real-time for the operators, and real-time in a much more aggressive way throughout the system. So an operator has much more flexibility in having real-time control over how the system operates. It's all those daily management issues that if we can get more and more of those eliminated, then they are not part of the uncertainty as we look to the future and are critical to our success. We have, we're looking at downsizing a lot of our buildings internally. LEED standards have been adopted in the city of Seattle. We're looking at strengths and vulnerabilities. We're trying to test the system. 2 years ago, we took the Tolt Reservoir, and we drove it 25 feet lower than it had ever been driven before, and we did it on purpose, because we had a lot of modeled results over the last 30 years that said this is what happens if you drive it that low, but we really didn't know. And we drove it that low. And then we experienced the worst of all conditions, which was 9 inches of rain in about 12 hours and windstorms on newly exposed reservoir bottom. And what we saw was the consequences of the modeling versus the actual sedimentation of our water supply. And we found that the sedimentation rates in our water supply were about a fifth of what the modeled levels were. Now we know we can drive that reservoir lower than we ever have before if we need to. You need to start looking at where are those opportunities to actually test your system. We've modified the temperature gradients in the Tolt system, so we're taking water from three different levels of the system. Now we have the ability to do that with our intakes. Why is that important? Because in the future, we're also dealing with fish flows below the river and temperature in streams. Historically, we took the water off the top. It was the hottest water. We've now started experimenting, taking it from various levels in the reservoir to see if we can mimic controlled stream conditions in other areas. Again, to give us more flexibility, less uncertainty in the future on how we manage the system. So we're pushing the system in all those areas to find out what can the system really do and how can we really maximize its use as we look forward. Because if we don't do that, we're not going to be effective in utilizing the resource that we currently have. Next. Many of you have probably seen this, and it is really an uncertainty chart on trying to figure out how do you deal with forecasting climate change. David's here, I think, actually. It's David's chart. Part of the issue for us has been the challenge. It's easy to do the bottom-up stuff. It's easy for us to say, what are our vulnerabilities? How can we change the resource? How do we maximize it? It's much harder taking global weather data and making it regional weather, U.S. weather data, and or climate estimates, making it state estimates, making it regional estimates, making it basin estimates, and saying, and that's what the impact of climate change is going to be on our watershed. I mean, what happens is you have a realm of scenarios of a million or a half a million, because depending upon the inputs, your outputs give you all kinds of different scenarios. It was a question earlier today on sea rise. I could give you 50 of them that might be effective. I can give you 100 of them. How do you make decisions over what scenarios to plan to? I think that's going to be our big challenge. Go ahead. This just talks a little bit more about some of the work that's done, and I'll move on. Keep going to the next slide. This is what we did some work with the University of Washington back in 2002, trying to say, so with the best information we have available now, and we look at a whole range of alternatives, what are the average impacts of climate change on our system? And we came up with a list. Now, having said this, this is an average. This is a classic. You have your hand in the refrigerator and your hand in the oven and your average temperature in the middle. It doesn't work real well. But this, when you start doing scenario planning, you have to make some decisions on what you're going to look at for consequences. So when you look at that, what it says is we're going to have increases in temperature. no change in precipitation. There'll be a change in the way we get precipitation of snow versus rain, but no change in the precipitation. Decreases in snowpack of 50%. Decreases in inflows, that's inflows to our reservoir, and decreases in yield. That all assumes a static system and that our operators don't change the way we're doing with dealing with rural curves, dealing with flood pockets, dealing with other issues. And so that is the impact of operating the system like we have historically. That is the impact on our system. The issue is we, from today on, we can't operate the system the way we used to. And so we have to start changing and coming up with new models on how we're going to deal with it. Next slide. I have found this a phenomenal chart. If you start at the upper left and you go down line by line on this chart, it shows you the official demand forecasts for the City of Seattle water supply system. And we have never, at least to date, we have never under-forecast demand. We always have over-forecast event. We're getting closer, but I think if you haven't done that and looked at your official forecast, it just gives you a reality check on what you have done historically and what the demands really look like. Next chart. I think you also, if you haven't looked, and I'm assuming most have, this is what our water consumption looks like versus our demand, versus our population increases. We have had significant population increases. Our demand has continued to decline about 2 to 2.5% a year, both in wholesale and retail customers, about half retail customers in Seattle, half wholesale customers. We're continuing to see, although it's starting to moderate a little bit, but a decrease in demand. There is a significant amount of supply in your existing demand, and you need to figure out how to access that. Next chart. If you look at peak day and annual average water, if you look at the bottom of the chart and annual average and you look at peak, there's a lot of room between those two lines. That is untapped supply, and I could get 20 to 30 to 40 million gallons tomorrow by pricing alone, pricing on the commercial side and pricing on the residential side. And so as you look at supply, people tend to forget that one of the best ways to do it is you can just price supply. And it gives you an opportunity. And that is one of the reasons that we've had the conservation programs and pricing. We have a very aggressive tiered pricing schedule. Is the reason we're not using as much water as we did before. Next chart. This is important because we're going to add one thing to this chart. But we've gone to a new forecasting model that really tries to model on the demand side the impacts of potential impacts on climate change. We've done scenario planning and done a tremendous number of scenarios and built into that the impacts of temperature on our demand, which is primarily, for us at least, there's a direct relationship between temperature and demand during peak season in the summer. And we've done a very good job at doing that on demand. We're now trying to take the yield curve, the upper line, and we're trying to figure out how do we develop a confidence band around that yield curve so that it also, because of climate change, we have a better feel for what our system can truly yield by having some kind of confidence. And the confidence band actually, in some instances, will show increased supply for us in certain scenarios on climate change. Because depending upon the way precipitation occurs and the way we manage our system and we manage for flood pockets and others, it could change the system. It could also depress demand. If we get high-intensity, short-duration storms in the summer, in Seattle, our demand drops off the end of the table. And if we get that once a week, our demand goes down 30 to 40 million gallons a day. Next. The other issue is, just if you haven't looked, you ought to look at the relative use of water in the world, of where the United States sits per capita versus Australia, Japan, Russia, Germany, China. You pick your own countries. There is capacity in the system to deal with some of the impacts of climate change. Other countries have started to deal with that. Australia is in year 6 or 7 of their drought now. So I think there is capacity there, and there's something you ought to look at. Next. And then finally, just back to maybe adding a couple issues to the chart that are on here. One, if you haven't done it, you really ought to also be looking at your financial systems and have financial stability and rate stability now, particularly if you're going to have to deal with rate increases in the future. to deal with this issue. You ought to be paying a lot of attention to where you are now with your rates, because that is going to be shock for people. You need to keep flexible. The biggest problem I'm having now is people trying to solve my problem for me by giving me all these ideas they want me to invest in today, so I'll have water in 30 or 40 years. I don't know what's going to happen in 30 or 40 years. And to want to go out and make huge capital investments now may or may not be the right approach. And I think you all need to look at that within your own utilities. And so I think it's just something we need to be careful about. And not over, we need to react and do this in a logical way, and not overreact and do things that don't make sense and are going to cost our ratepayers a lot of money and aren't going to contribute to solving the problem. As you look to the future, you need to be flexible and adaptive going forward, because we're going to be getting a lot more information year by year as we go forward. And finally, I would really reiterate that what you really need to do is try and get control over all those things you know you can control. That uncertainty in your system that currently is there, I would try to grab that and minimize that, because the uncertainty in climate change is so overwhelming that you just can't afford to have a lot of other uncertainty in your system. So, thank you.
Good morning. My name is Edward Campbell, and I'm the Resource Protection and Planning Director for Portland Water Bureau in Portland, Oregon. And I'm here on behalf of David Schaff, our Water Bureau Administrator, who sends his regrets. I'm very glad to be here today. Before I start in on the story of Portland, I just want to say that the morning session really has painted a picture for me of the scale of the issues that you face down here in California. And I hope that the story that I'm going to tell you about Portland, in which we are a drinking water only utility, and we are 80 miles away from the Pacific Ocean, that there are lessons that can be useful for you. But I can assure you that from my perspective, our issues pale in comparison to the things that you are dealing with down here. So first a quick description of the Portland water system. It's the largest system in Oregon. It serves about 800,000 people, which is about 25% of the state. And then we average 100 million gallons of water a day. Our primary source is the Bull Run River, which is located in the Cascade Mountain Range east of the city. And we have two reservoirs on that river and about 10 billion gallons of usable storage. We also have a secondary supplemental source, a groundwater source, on the south shore of the Columbia River. And that we have enough capacity there to serve our base needs just from groundwater. First slide, please. Okay, thanks. So you can count Portland among those who have believed in climate change, believe that it is real, and that have been following it for over two decades. The city is a national leader on global warming policy. It's one of the first cities to have CO2 emission reduction goals. I know I need to tread carefully here in San Francisco talking about our leadership in this area, but I think it's a good competition between the two cities. Most of you are probably familiar with the list that I have up here on this slide in terms of the predicted impacts for continued global warming trends on Western water utilities. Perhaps the most fundamental, I think, just to kind of cut to the heart of it, what we're really struggling with is the notion that we may face increased demands in the summer while having reduced supplies. Next slide, please. So in terms of the climate change impacts that Portland is most concerned about, here are five, at least according to me and my staff, and I'm sure there's more, but in thinking about this, tried to focus in on some things that we're dealing with now. So as I just mentioned, the higher summertime demands due to higher temperatures, this would be growth in our demand beyond what we anticipate by growth alone. That's a significant issue. The other side of the coin with that is that having less supply during the summer. And if we are in a situation in which we have a longer drought period, we like Seattle, have annual refill schedule with our reservoirs, and we go through a summer drawdown period in which we're actually serving from our reservoirs. If that period increases on a regular basis, then that presents some significant challenges for us. Increased risk of wildfire, this is a huge concern for us. I imagine it's a similar concern for other unfiltered water systems like Seattle, like San Francisco. We are an unfiltered drinking water source. Our watershed is in the Mount Hood National Forest where there's lots of recreation. Even though our watershed is protected and there's no entry allowed into our watershed, we are a neighbor of a very highly intensely utilized area in the Mount Hood National Forest. Water rights issues, for us, this is only an issue with regard to our groundwater source, but we do share that aquifer. There's actually a series of aquifers. We do share that with neighboring water jurisdictions, and also we have the city of Vancouver on the other side of the Columbia River, which also taps that reservoir. Finally, impacts to fish flows. This could potentially affect our ability to maintain regulatory compliance. We're currently in the process of pursuing a habitat conservation plan, a 50-year habitat conservation plan to come into compliance with the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act for our system. So we're very concerned about any impacts that could impact our ability to maintain fish flows that we're currently agreeing to. Next slide. So in terms of what we've done to study climate change impacts on our system, in 2002, we, through the University of Washington, conducted a study by Dr. Richard Palmer and Margaret Hahn. I won't get into the details of exactly what this model was, but we can come back to that if the modeling issue is something that's interesting or that we want to talk more about. So next slide. So a couple of the major impacts out of this study that we conducted, and central to the title of this panel, is the reduction of our snowpack. Now, the Bull Run watershed is not particularly a snow-rich environment. We do regularly get snowfall. Our highest elevation in the watershed is about 3,500 feet. So what we do have, which you'll see up on the board there, is the dotted line showing our regular runoff of the streams in the Bull Run, and then the dark line showing what we would project to happen without snowfall. It's not particularly significant, particularly for our municipal supply. One of the reasons for this is that because of our late spring rain period in Portland area, what we typically see happen is the snowfall that does accumulate within the watershed is scoured out in late April and May. And so where this impact will have a much more significant impact is on our fish flows potentially. Next slide. So another thing that the Palmer study provided us with was a representation of the effect that climate change would have on our projected demand. And so you can see the higher line there represents what we think would happen based on the climate change effect, and that's about an 8% bump over normal projected peak demand in 2040. So that right there is our population-based 2040 projections and then a climate change-enhanced version. The footnote to this slide is that since we conducted our study, and this speaks to something that Chuck just mentioned, is our projected demands are significantly lower than when we did this study. And so that's really been one of the issues that we've been trying to understand, how to incorporate that into our planning when the demand has not been going up in the same way that it has in the past. So there's a fundamentally different relationship. Part of it is per capita consumption going down. Part of it is a change in just the nature of the land use in our area. We're seeing less high-intensive water use by industrial users, and we're seeing a lot of infill with residential and high-density residential. And so these are some of the things that we're still trying to figure out how that impacts our planning. Next slide. So what are we doing as a result of this work? Well, first, we plan to update our work using newer global climate change models and local watershed models. There's new models being developed this year for the IPCC, and we think that these will be better for us in terms of downscaling the global climate change effects into a more regional or local watershed scale. I would say the rest of this list are things that are informed by the work that we did on our climate change study. So these aren't things that we went out and set out to do specifically because we had done the study, but in doing all these things, now we do have in the back of our mind what we learned from our climate change. So just to go through some of these, for an example, we just completed new wholesale water sale agreements with all of our wholesale customers, and it's a significantly different package. It's a very different agreement. We actually have capped the total amount of water that the city of Portland is obligated to provide to our customers. So that was a way in which we actually took control and gained some demand control over our previous arrangement, which we were basically obligated to provide whatever demand came from our wholesale customers. We're updating our conservation rates to address summer peak use. We're considering the results of the climate change work as we negotiate with the federal regulatory agencies on our ESA compliance. We're assessing our groundwater system to evaluate and plan for our future capacity and reliability. And then we're working regionally, both to set up interconnections and to encourage some of our regional partners to conduct studies of their own, and they're starting to do that. So I'm right on time. 1 minute. Last slide. So I'll conclude with the additional information that we'd like to see. We're still working from rather broad assumptions that are derived from the global climate change models. And so we need to continue to refine and improve our understanding of local and sub-watershed effects. We need to continue to assemble reliable data sets on historic conditions to use in the models. If we, you know, it's the old garbage in, garbage out problem. We as water utilities, I think it's incumbent upon us to figure out the ways to get the good data that then can feed the models. I mean, we're trying to work with the academic community. They're doing a lot of work on these global scales. We need to get a handle on our local data and information. We need better precipitation information. The current models are not considered as reliable for precipitation impacts as they are for temperature. As Chuck noted, if in the Portland area, if we were to see precipitation events during the summer, it would change our consumption patterns considerably and would change the need for future supply capacity greatly. And so until we understand better whether or not that's a real possibility, it's very difficult for us to make capital investment decisions. And then finally, we're going to need models that are going to be able to address increasing levels of complexity. You know, we have multiple and often synergistic water system functions and activities. For Portland, we have a relatively simple system. It's primarily for drinking water. We do have hydro facilities on both our dams. And we do, of course, we're planning and are in the process of providing fish flows. Other systems that are dealing with recreation uses, navigation, the whole gambit of things that go on in a water system, we need models that can incorporate that level of complexity. That's it for me. Thank you so much. I look forward to our ongoing conversation.
Good morning. Jared said in his introduction that this panel was going to talk about how we're planning for the worst and how we're planning for disasters. It's probably one of the worst introductions I've had, which is, you know, it's such a downer. Who wants to hear it, really? So as a result of that introduction, Jared, I've decided to entitle my presentation this morning, "I Feel So Much Better Since I Gave Up Hope." Welcome to California Water. I'm not going to talk about the analyses that were done. I'm not going to talk about some of the technical planning that we have done. I'm going to really focus on water management and what we've done specifically related to that in San Diego. I want to give you just a brief overview of who the San Diego County Water Authority is. We're the regional wholesaler. We supply to 24 retailers. We import water from the Colorado River. And as you may know, the Colorado River is entering into in its seventh year of drought and record low levels on the reservoirs. The other water we get is from Northern California, which, as you know, wildly fluctuates. So I always figure I don't need to gamble. I just work in California Water. And it, you know, it, you get the same sensation of putting it on the line all the time. We have a large capital improvement program, and it's part of analysis and ultimately the response that we have done to some of these challenges. Let me show you where our transmission line is. We go from the northern border of San Diego County, think of Camp Pendleton, all the way to the Mexican border, 300 miles of pipe, 10, it's now about 13 feet in diameter. We serve about 3.2 million people a year and support an economy of about $150 billion. Next slide. There is my life. You are here. There I am. I'm at the corner. I'm at the bottom of the pipes. I'm in a really bright orange-yellow area. We get an average of 8 inches of rain per year. So we have there is very little that we can do related to rainfall, local runoff, and so forth. Our strategies have to be radically different than strategies that Edward and Chuck have sitting in Portland and Seattle. And I think that if there's anything that you take away is there is not a one-size-fits-all to any of this, not for California, not for the western states. You really have to customize based on where you are sitting. Climate change and urban water supply, obviously growing demand for water. However, we grew nearly 10 years in San Diego County, increased by a population of over 600,000 people, and we did not add to our water demand. And that came from just extraordinary efforts in conservation, recycling, mining our groundwater, and so forth. But the growing demand, we have hardened conservation, and, you know, we have continuing growth. And so as a result, increased population, our economic activity, and obviously hotter and drier weather. Uncertainty of our imported and certainly our small local surface supply is a concern. Less reliance on the hydrological dependent supplies, and all of that needs to be taken into consideration. How we are responding is really a three-prong action plan. I want to just touch lightly on each of these. First is diversification of our water supply portfolio. Second is constructing a variety of facilities to help our region address the ever-changing demands that we have. And then third is implementation of prudent planning through drought management and looking at the situation before it's on you and how you are going to address shortage of supplies. Our water supply strategy is not just the diversification, but also maximizing the efficient use of our existing resources and then continuing to reduce demands on imported supplies, continuing that effort to try to manage both sides of the issue, the demand side as well as the supply side. Let me show you what our portfolio looked like, not a very diverse portfolio in the past. 1991, we had a 31% cutback in real supplies that year. We actually implemented 31% cutback in the San Diego region during that year. We had two sources, local supplies through our reservoir system and then our imported sources. So we embarked upon efforts to really diversify that supply. Conservation, as I told you, we grew huge in 1990s, yet our demands remain the same. And a lot of that was through improving our local supply, and that was our first focus, was conservation, recycled water, groundwater. And now we are adding other opportunities for local supply, such as seawater desalination and surface storage in order to gain whatever additional water we can with that small amount of rainfall. And then we implemented the Colorado River Quantification Settlement Agreement. You may have heard about that, which was a multi-party, multi-state agreement, which basically through funding conservation in Imperial Valley on farm and in their system, we're able to conserve water, and that water then moves to the urban area. So you have the concept of a win-win. Farmers are able to continue to farm in a more efficient manner, and we are able to utilize and tap into water supplies that in the past we have not been able to do. And then also we're lining a couple canals, earthen canals, that will save additional water. So we are moving. You saw what 1991 looked like. In 2005, we had a pretty big chunk. We increased conservation, recycled. I went through that. By 2011, we will have added seawater desalination. The canal lining projects will be complete, and that water will be conserved. And the Imperial Irrigation District Water Transfer and Conservation Program will represent about 10% of our supply portfolio. By 2020, you can see we will have achieved a more diverse supply portfolio that no longer is solely dependent on the hydrology coming out of the Bay Delta and the Colorado River. The second piece of the strategy is really the authority's capital improvement program. We recently recosted our program, which is about a 20-25-year CIP program, and it will cost us $4.3 billion to implement it, and we are on a track to do so. We like to say we put our money where our mouth is. If we truly want water supply and water reliability, we need to pay for it. It does not come cheap. Someone asked earlier at the earlier panel, you know, what if the projections are wrong? We're talking a lot of money. I guess my concern is, what if the projections are right? Are you willing to jeopardize your community's water reliability by saying, well, you know, we may not have to do that? Now, what some of our CIP, what we're implementing, may make no sense whatsoever in other communities, other areas. Where we're spending our money may make no sense in Seattle, where they have a different portfolio, different supplies, different timing. So we've got a variety of components that we're doing, and we're going to be spending between $200 and $400 million per year for a really long time. What's important, though, is that our community understands it. Communication is critical in getting the community to understand the situation, to realize how these climate changes and our vulnerability really play out in water reliability, and get them to support it. Let me show you a couple of the emergency storage project. We're spending nearly $1 billion to set aside 90,000 acre feet of water, which will be housed within San Diego County. That is to avoid our major pipelines that import our water cross over five major faults. So as a result, we're going to store within the county. The second one is we're also doing an additional 100,000 feet of carryover storage, raising an existing dam that's 200 feet tall. We're raising it by another 125 feet. So it will be an interesting project to complete. And that will be finished. It starts in about a year and will be finished by 2012. The next one is seawater desalination. Because we are on the coast, we have some opportunities. We have intake and outfalls with existing power plants, and even though those plants may go away, those intakes and outfalls are critical for us to achieve that piece of our water portfolio. And then drought management planning, that is, okay, what happens if we are short in a year? What do you do? And it really is talking about doing that planning now, getting buy-off, understanding by the community early on, so that everybody knows if supplies are short, where do we go? I think one of the greatest challenges is, next slide please, is how do you encourage agencies to develop local supplies, but then if a shortage occurs, those local supplies may not be available. We have to balance that in the drought management plan. And on the next slide, you'll see, you'll see hardly anything. But if, love those colors. But the idea is it's a multi-pronged strategy where no one agency takes the brunt of the shortage. That just because you have an agency, you can't have an agency at a 50% cut and then another agency at only a 90% cut. In San Diego County, and I'm sure there's many communities here like that, where you live in one community and you work in another, and that we all are ultimately joined together at the hip in our economy. In summary, I think there's no silver bullets. It's going to require various strategies, multiple tools, and flexibility to get all of us through these changing times. Thank you.
Thank you. One of the benefits of going later, maybe it's a benefit, I just start crossing off all the stuff I was going to say because everybody's kind of hit it. Now, I do want to start by thanking Jared for his complete plan. I did text in, and we've got you signed on to SB 59. So, you know, I actually want to start with the conclusions, and I'll repeat them at the end. And Maureen hit them, and actually everybody's been hitting these themes. First, to make it clear, and this already came up this morning, climate-induced changes of water supply has been going on for about 50 years. This isn't something we're talking about in the future. It's already here. And that's been very difficult to get the water community to really understand that. It's not something that you bide your time and maybe you retire. It's already in our face, and we need to be managing it now. And we're not doing a particularly good job at that. Maureen hit just a fundamental point, a conclusion. There are no silver bullets. You have to have a comprehensive approach to this. The next conclusion is that we have to build diverse water management portfolios in every region of the state. And I like the language. Jared started off with that, talking about a portfolio. He used the term hedges. And we really are bringing kind of the business risk management language into water management, where you build a diverse portfolio, you develop hedges, hedge accounts, and you have contingency plans. Because you can't plan for certainty with the future water supply. You have to be prepared to respond to uncertain conditions. The next item is that the statewide system, and we have such a robust statewide system in California, has to be reevaluated in terms of its operations. How do we operate this system in the face of what we're seeing? We can't assume we operate it the way that we always have. And that reoperation will likely require some reconfiguration. Now, the final point, and it's not really the topic of this panel, as you do these portfolios, as you consider reoperation of the system, we have to manage the greenhouse gases. We have to manage the carbon footprint. So as we make changes, we're actually reducing our contribution to the problem. We can't simply manage the effect and not pay attention to our portion of the contribution to greenhouse gases. Those all have to be part of the way that we simply proceed. Next slide. And I only have 200 slides, so don't panic out there. The simple point here, I don't need to spend a lot of time on it, but in California, the issues that we're seeing is reduced snowpack, a lot earlier snowmelt. It's really changing the hydrograph we're experiencing, higher temperatures that will impact ecosystem directly, both in terms of the kinds of plants that will be taking up the rainfall as it falls, but also the temperature of the water that we have for certain aquatic species. Sea level rise, a dramatic impact in the Delta. Next slide. When we look at snowpack changes, one of the questions in the earlier panel was the different projections. Now, what we typically use is to say that we expect at least a 25% reduction in snowpack by 2050. And so we depend on our snowpack being a 15 million acre-foot reservoir on average. We will lose 25%. Some of the other projections that you will see is losing 40% of that snowpack by 2050. And that's not that far away. And there are projections that are actually worse than that. Now, typically, we've shown the nature of the reduced amount of runoff, the reduced percentage of runoff that occurs as a result of snowpack. We're now starting to look at this a little differently from a flood perspective. Next slide. And this may not be obvious. This is the peak day flows from a given year. So it's the highest flow you experienced in a river system, in this case the American River, in a given year. So here's when Folsom Dam was built. And you look back, these were the kind of peak flows that the Corps of Engineers used to design the operations manual for flood management. Those were the kind of flows they used to study how you would operate the reservoir. Now look since it was built. Six of the highest flows recorded on the American River have happened since the dam was built. Has the Corps changed the operating criteria? No. And we tend to ignore these. Now, we've been aware of this for some time from a flood standpoint. Next slide. This is the Feather River, less dramatic, but here Orville was constructed on the Feather River. And again, and if you added in 2006, where we had flood flows, you would have four of the highest flows on the Feather River have occurred since we constructed Orville. And again, we're operating from a flood standpoint, not really taking this into consideration. You manage very differently, but in terms of the rule curves that the Corps would have you follow, there's not much change in those. Final example, San Joaquin River, exactly the same thing. When Fryant Dam was built, and you can see that the highest flows, again, 2006 is missing from this, which would be up among the highest. We had very high flows on the San Joaquin. There's a couple of points here. One, the flashier nature of the hydrograph that we're experiencing and will continue to experience. As we lose snowpack, it will actually get worse. The other is from a flood management standpoint. I don't know if we have any flood people in the audience, but if you think of what we talk about, the 100-year flood, it has a chance of occurring one in 100 years, a 100-year storm. Most of that analysis was done in the first half of the last century, or the middle of the last century. So maybe in the 60s we updated some of those. All the higher flows have occurred since then. So what is the real 100-year event now? And what is it going to be? And so how do you design your flood systems to deal with that? And they better be robust and resilient and not designed around fortress levees. Next slide. Again, kind of a summary. Much higher inflows during winter, early spring. We have to maintain greater flood control space, and if all you do is operate to provide greater flood control space, you probably lose water supply. We clearly have to reoperate current reservoirs. And in California, the state or anyone else talking about how you should operate your reservoir is heresy. And that is going to be a real challenge. We can talk about how we reoperate the state water project, but when I start talking about how we reoperate everybody else's reservoirs, that is a whole different ballgame. And yet we have to do that very methodically. Let's go on to the next slide. A California Water Plan laid out a basic approach to how to deal with our future uncertainty and our future strategies. And it really is based around these diverse portfolios. And I'm just going to hit a few elements. There aren't any scenarios in which California should not and can avoid redoubling its conservation effort. You have to address demand. I mean, to some extent, what we can look at with climate change is like a family budget, where all of a sudden you used to have stable revenue coming in, but now it's sporadic. One year you may make hardly anything. The next year you make a whole lot of money. And how are you going to manage that? Well, one way is you control your cost. Try to keep your costs down. The other way is you have bank accounts or you have relatives that you can borrow from. That's a longer story. That's never worked for me. So we have to do things to increase revenue, increase water supplies, desalination, wastewater recycling, actually developing more yield through storage, improve water quality. The point was brought up this morning. The higher the quality of your water that you bring into your system, the more you can do with it. The easier it is to recycle it, the more things that you can do with it. The less higher the quality, probably the less energy you have to put into it to treat it. Practice resource stewardship. If hopefully the water industry has learned that it's not just an issue of supply, it's an issue of managing the natural resource and all of the issues that go with that. And if you don't, those environmental issues, those natural resource issues will come back to bite you and actually undermine your supply reliability. A final point on this slide is improved operational efficiency in transfers, and part of that goes to the statewide system and how we operate it, and it really means needing to evaluate evaluate the reoperation of the system. Next slide. I want to make a point here where Governor Schwarzenegger and the legislature put Prop 1E, a flood bond, and Prop 84 was an initiative. We end up with about $5 billion for flood, about $1 billion for integrated regional water management. The key point here is we actually have a lot of money on the table to start changing the nature of the system. And we can't do things the way that we've always done them. We have to have a very different approach to how we invest this money. Next slide. On that foundation, then, the governor has proposed some additional investments. And so the two things combined, you basically have every tool that you can imagine on the table. Now, we have proposed expanding storage, both groundwater and surface water. Surface water is clearly the most controversial. Investing in sustainability of the Delta, which is largely non-structural investment in the Delta. Additional conservation money and resource stewardship for some specific conflict problems. But the idea is we now have all the tools. Tools are not fungible. Conservation isn't the same as replacing snowpack. You have to do it, but you have to put the right package together to make sure that you have the resilience that you're looking for. Surface storage doesn't operate the same as groundwater storage. Desal doesn't provide the same benefit as having water in a groundwater basin. So it's putting together the right portfolio that gives you the resilience to deal with that future uncertainty. And finally, getting back to the greenhouse gases, last slide, that as you put that together, we've got to keep an eye on what is the carbon footprint of the water industry. That's a tough one to get our arms around. We're not used to thinking that way, and yet we have to develop models so that every urban water management plan, every regional plan is addressing greenhouse gases in a uniform fashion. Thanks.
Good afternoon. Good morning. It's 12:45. I'm the last speaker. Everybody's hungry. Susan got me here because she told me, if you've seen the Al Gore movie, that I would have a platform. I could push a button, go up and down, and point to the charts. It's not here. And then she told me I'd be the last speaker. But Susan's such a good politician, she said, and that's where you do your best work because you can wrap up. I look at it as I'll take my shots as they come here. I am here primarily as the chair of the American Water Works Research Foundation, something I've done for the last 2 or 3 years. We have some staff. Elizabeth, if you could raise your hand over here. I'm going to talk about a report that's been done that I think is fundamentally the best resource any water manager could have right now. Many of us have too much to read, and someone says, here's a 300-page report, learn about global warming and what you need to do. This is called a primer. I actually read it, 65 pages, but it has a very detailed CD if you want more information. What this starts with for all of us is how many in this room could even tell us the fundamentals of climate and weather change? Most of us, one man, thank you. Two, then you don't need to read this. The fundamentals of that are what we learn listening to the radio or watching the weatherman. And that is not good enough for us because we're going to have to learn the language because we don't want to be sitting around feeling unnerved when someone says the sea levels could go 25 feet. That's not where we take our customers. That's not where we as leaders take others. We must know what's real, what is in the range of possibility, and what's affecting it. So number one, this report is the best primer you're going to get on what is affecting climate. Secondly, we all hear about the poles are shrinking, Antarctica, the Arctic, and we think about the glaciers and the warming, but based on knowledge from this, you start to understand how they play a much bigger role with respect to water vapor, with respect to reflecting energy from the sun. There are things that you need to know so you can play. Knowledge is empowerment. We don't need a bunch of people fearful. We don't need a bunch of us, many of us are managers, to have to make hard decisions and make investments. We need to be empowered and knowledgeable. Secondly, this looks at a state of the art of what is real, fact, or fiction about global warming. What is real, fact, or fiction? Because we are going to have to make investment decisions. And we have to know, yes, it could go 25 feet, but many of us will not be here in 150 years. We're going to have to make investments that are going to be adaptable and real for us over the next 10 to 20 years. And so you need to start to get in your minds a range of possibility. And finally, the worst thing we could do, and I'm also a general manager of Water District, is to believe that we are not going to have to start making the investments, we're not going to have to build it in our CFPs, because we could flip the switch on what's causing this today, and the trends that we are seeing are going to continue for 10 to 20 years. Understand that? So we're not going to be able to go back to our customers and say, we are going to get active, we're going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, we're going to do things that are going to stop it. We have several things. First of all, we don't control the whole world's gas emissions. We can only do what we can do, and by the way, that's a lot, since 5% of the population produces 25% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. So we can do a lot, don't get me wrong. But there's emerging giants economically in India and China that are moving ahead very aggressively. So we can do what we control, and we can try to help others. But when we go back, we have to start looking at our CIPs, our capital investment programs, and say, I heard this morning Tom say, well, you know, this could be, if it goes up a foot, we'd have to change these weirs. Guess what? Put it in your CIP, it's going to go up a foot. And we're going to have to start educating our customers and the people we serve that this problem is here to stay. It is no different than any other problem we've had to deal with. It is another problem that's here to stay, and we are going to have to make the investments. So message number one. Message number two. I want to talk a little about what Lester just talked about, the state, and a question I heard this morning. What do we do about the Delta? What do we do if we don't know where to go? My agency represents 100% of its supply in the Delta. So we are the miner's canary for the health of the Delta. That does not mean we have sat back waiting for the Delta to be improved. We're spending close to $1.5 billion to try to diversify from the Delta. But with the assets that Lester talked about that we could be investing in, we are going to have to invest in the Delta in a way that creates adaptability and creates what I call a twofer. Example, we have to do some levee improvements in the Delta, or we could have what some people would call a Katrina-type event when the big one hits. If we don't invest in levees that are not only going to protect us from a major earthquake, but starts to improve the water quality on the west side of the Delta, which has an impact in the smelt, and can also be the bottle, the cork in the bottle, when in fact global warming continues to raise the sea level. When we look at it that way, we might be able to have a plan that is adaptable and sustainable. I listened to a professor the other day who is the chair of one of the technical groups advising on what levees ought to be invested in. And when he was finished, he said, the levees on the west side of the Delta, they're not worth saving, frankly, because it's very poor soil and they're big islands, Brannan, Sherman. And I raised my hand and I said, and so what you're saying is the Delta will become salt water. And what are you going to say to the species that live there and the people that drink there? And he says, oh, no, I'm a levee expert. I don't know anything about the multiple uses. I'm just saying which levees ought to be invested in. Well, the point is, we can't all go into silos and start saying, well, those are levees we ought to invest in for flood protection, and those are levees we ought to invest in for water quality. We're going to have to integrate and adapt. And Lester's program that he comes up with, I like the word we're using. Everybody's talking about robust, adaptive. But I will tell you that the programs we invest in, if we're not smart, we heard we'll get fired. If we invest, overinvest, we'll get fired. If we underinvest, the point of the whole matter is, we have to invest in something like we've always done. We built our first wastewater plants. I was in the wastewater business. We had to look what our population was going to be 20 years from now. If you build a wastewater plant that sat there waiting for the population, you would get fired. That's a stranded asset, and those are the terminology we have to use on these programs. We invest in the things today that will become the foundation for the solution tomorrow, and we keep building on those in a way that will work. And the state has the resources now, and in probably, I think, in about a year and a half, we can't do any more studies. We need to move on action steps that are going to work not only for the global warming scenario, will work for the endangered species scenario, will work for the flood and seismic scenario, and we can make those decisions. And I don't fear them, because I think we have good enough engineers, we have good enough solutions, and in coupled with what Lester finally concluded with, we have to get a handle on the CO2 gas emissions. I don't care, frankly, if people believe global warming is real or not. I try to stay away from that, because you can get people arguing, say, climate change is here, and it's not going to change. unless we do something about it. And while we're doing something about it, it's going to be more volatile and it's going to cause more problems. Now, finally, what am I doing as a manager of our district? Well, I started to say that we live in the Delta, everything we get's from the Delta, but we spent $1 billion, we built our own reservoir with local ratepayers, very controversial because it spiked rates, but we thought it was the right thing to do. We're in part of a desal program that's going to look at diversifying in that area. We are now, right after filling a new intake for the reservoir, going to spend another $100 million and move it. Why? Because the Delta is getting saltier on the west side, and we believe that's going to be a trend that continues, particularly with global warming, particularly with the export pumping, particularly with some of the runoff patterns. So we're going to invest in that. Our 50-year water supply program, our new supplies, and we've doubled our population. We will be 700,000 people, whether we want to or not, in another 10 years. When I got there a little over 10 years ago, we were 300,000, one of the fastest growing areas in Northern California. You know, we're serving less water today than we were when I got there. Conservation, reclamation is the cornerstone of our growth. But anybody who doesn't know what that does to demand hardening and what that means with respect to drought or any other emergency you may have is not playing with a fair deck. When you harden the demand, you must have flexibility. And our reservoir, by the way, is not a reservoir for supply. And people are still taking shots at that reservoir. That reservoir was built as a water quality salt reservoir and a fish asset. And there are some people that just the other day said it's a poster child for bad storage. The answer is it is exactly off-stream storage that uses peak demands to blend water quality in an area that's going to be affected by the issues we're talking about today. Diversification, reliance on conservation and reclamation are going to be the keys for our future. So, if I can get you to do nothing else, I would like you to read this because I consider it a very significant primer for anybody who has to deal with this. Secondly, stay with adaptive management and the things we need to do, and the state has the resources now if we think broadly about how to invest them. And then you've had some very excellent manager talk to you about what their programs are, which are very consistent with the direction we're going. Thank you.
Well, that was a terrific panel, and I've been told that we have until 12:55 to have some Q&A here with the audience. So we have microphones on both sides of the room, and we'll start over here.
Thank you. Matt Vanderslice from the Planning and Conservation League. I had two questions for Director Snow. The first, you mentioned that it's difficult to get the water community to understand global warming. And I think that's very true, and we're happy to work with you in that process. To help with that and to help educate everyone here in that room, are you planning on including climate change in your next State Water Project Delivery Reliability Report so that everyone in this room understands what they should be facing as they start to make decisions? The second question is, with AB 32, one of the first parts of the implementation is the adoption of initial actions. And we've heard from the governor that he's very interested in having all state agencies undertake some initial actions, things that can be implemented by 2010 to reduce our carbon footprint. And we strongly recommend a certification program for the California Urban Water Conservation Council's best management practices. What sorts of things is DWR looking at implementing as those initial actions? Thanks.
Okay. I was trying to think of the question. There was a big statement in there. But let me clarify my point, since I'm up here with the California water community, about how they're not paying attention to climate change. Actually, I think they're paying a lot of attention. Did I do better? my point there was, when you talk about the California water community, it is thousands and thousands of people. All spread across the state. And so try to get people to focus on what's the most meaningful piece of information on climate change. I mean, one of the problems that I run into is sometimes you bring up the issue of climate change and people care about it, but their eyes glaze over because there's all these charts with lines that cross and go out into the future. And so how do you develop that succinct message so it's really relevant to a water utility that may serve 5,000 people in a foothill somewhere. And that's the point that I was trying to make there. In terms of what's DWR doing to kind of integrate climate change, our big focus right now is twofold. One, to make it a major feature of the California Water Plan update, which we're already gearing up to do the next installment of it. And the other is to bring it in a meaningful fashion as we distribute funds under Prop 84. So we have incentives for people to implement certain kinds of programs, and we're going to be having workshops on guidelines of how we can make this climate issue a preference or some sort of use the incentive of Prop 84 to get it in play there. Now, in terms of the governor's initiative, we've already formed a matrix team within the department. We're evaluating the carbon footprint of the State Water Project, for example, to look at our issues there. Obviously, we have a lot of hydro. I think some information I got this week is that our portion of the carbon footprint in California is like one-half of 1%. And so we're looking at that issue to see what we can do with our power portfolio to manage that better. So we've got all of those issues queued up. We hope we can provide financial incentives through 84 for people to invest in different programs. I think I've hit your question.
Lester, if I might follow up, I think where that question was going is, what are you telling your contractors about future reliability from the current system, setting aside whether we proceed with a strategic growth plan?
Well, we actually issued a major, is this on now, climate report, the one that there's a copy of. Kathy or Maury can hold that up back there. That's available on our website. That shows a 10% reduction of water supply due to the effects of climate change. Now, that assumed no aggressive management action, so it doesn't assume any of the kinds of things that we've discussed here that need to be done. But we're starting to send that signal out of what the potential impacts to water supply as a result of this snowpack primarily.
Thanks. This side of the room. Yes, in the back.
This time. Hi, I'm Roman Chvinyak with Defenders of Wildlife, a national nonprofit organization. My question is mostly to Maureen and Lester. One of the themes that was prominent in the first panel was the need for an integrated planning approach so that local land use planners aren't passing externalities onto state flood managers and water districts. Most of the metropolitan areas in California have engaged to some extent or another in their integrated regional blueprint plans that seek to integrate land use, housing, transportation, and conservation planning. I'm wondering to what extent the water authorities in San Diego were involved in the SANDAG plan, and what are the plans of DWR to integrate its regional planning efforts with these plans as we roll out the $40 billion in infrastructure bonds. Thanks.
SANDAG, which is our regional planning entity, and the Water Authority actually, as early as the early 1990s, began the development and ultimately the working relationship in regional planning, how it impacts water demands and so forth. As a matter of fact, our community adopted what was Proposition C, which mandated that regional planning, which included the water component as well. A lot of this SB 221 and 610 requirements that talked about regional planning and the integration of the regional planning agency with the water agencies, actually much of that was patterned after what San Diego had already been doing for nearly 10 years by the time those bills had been passed. We're very lucky in that we are unique in our region. We have a regional water agency and a regional planning agency, and that integration has probably been much easier than in some other areas in California, which may have multiple planning and multiple water agencies dealing with issues. It also has helped us enormously as we move forward with our integrated plan, in that, again, with the County of San Diego, SANDAG, the Water Authority, and so forth, our integrated plan effort has actually gone relatively smoothly, which is integrating our seven watersheds, our flood control, waste management, water supply, and so forth. So I think we're fortunate in that just by the makeup of how we developed and the agencies that are within our region.
All right. Question on this side of the room? Yes, back in the back. Spreck.
Thanks. Spreck Rosecrans, Environmental Defense. Question for Wally and Lester. You guys are water guys, but you're also Delta guys. And do you think there's development going on in the Delta in flood-prone areas that should not be currently permitted? And if so, what should we do about it?
Inconceivable, right?
Well, I mean, Spreck, you got to know that's a setup. Most of it's going on in my water district. Absolutely, the issue of local development, I don't believe can be dealt with locally. There is no way you're going to tell rural city councils or board of supervisors when a developer comes in and says your town will have a library, a firehouse, a new school, parks, and all you have to do is let us build 5,000 homes below the flood level. It's going to happen. And I heard Will this morning talk about it's not going to change probably until they can't get insurance. Now, what I happen to believe is going on, you may be speaking about probably one of the largest annexations just occurred for 8,000 homes in this area, is that the developers are being forced to put in, I don't know what it means anymore, 200-year flood levies. Before that is, the real question to me is when they leave and those levies have to be maintained by local reclamation districts that have created some of the problems we have with the levees in the Delta, will that happen? I don't know. But the question is a good one. The answer is I do not believe left to, and you're touching the third rail when you start telling local elected officials they can't develop the land within their local agency, but I do not believe that a local elected board is going to be able to stand up to the pressure as there's increasing pressure to build homes in the cheaper areas of California, many of which are in flood-prone areas.
Did you want to take a stab at that?
Not necessarily, but I will. I want to start with something I think we all agree on, and the voters agreed on it, and that is that California needs affordable housing. And so the voters even passed a bond to make sure that there was affordable housing. So that's the backdrop to these difficult issues. And a couple of thoughts. One, there's actually an issue queued up where we're going to have a showdown here shortly over a much smaller development, and it's called in Clarksburg, the old sugar mill, and it's only 142 units, but it's in what is supposed to be the primary zone of the Delta, and it's on a levee that has questionable parentage, and what will happen there. And so it's been queued up, and the Delta Protection Commission said it's not consistent with the Delta Protection Act. That clearly is headed to court, and I think there's a lot of stuff that will fall out of that. The other issue that two other things I want to mention. One that's just unique to the Delta. The Delta is a region, but it doesn't have the kind of same sense of place as the Chesapeake Bay or the Great Lakes or that sort of thing. And yet it's a region, but there's six counties that make the land use decisions that affect the Delta. And that's just a very difficult situation to have a unified strategy. Now, on a broader basis, we have been dealing for 2 years now with this issue of trying to integrate flood management risk assessment into land use planning. And it's been very difficult because there's great resistance to the state interfering with this. Last year we ended up being at odds not only with the Building Industry Association of California, but also the League of Cities and Towns and CSAC, the county organization, of not wanting us to interfere. We think we've got a different relationship this year, and we want to continue to push the issue of land use plans and land use planning processes, not just some sterile plan on a shelf, fully integrate the issue of flood risk into their land use decisions. And even more importantly, disclose those kinds of things as they proceed to develop property. One of the issues that we have in play is when we issue grants from 1E and 84 for flood management to perhaps a flood jurisdiction, we want the local land use entity that will be protected by that project to adopt a formal resolution acknowledging the flood risk associated with it. Very controversial. Seems pretty straightforward. But that fight is not over.
All right. Over on this side, in the back, yes.
Yes. My name is Laura Lee Marcus. I'm from the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce. And I have two questions, one that you're welcome to completely ignore and answer the second one if you'd like. The first one is, this conversation today seems opposed to the issue about draining Hetch Hetchy. So I'm wondering if you could just address that. How do you deal with that issue? My second question is, if you could just assure me that somewhere in your plans that you've taken into consideration the whole Terrace Act and through all of this water storage issue, that in all of your plans that the Terrace Act situation is under control.
Well, let's start with the easy one. Gene, did you want to address Hetch Hetchy? Maureen, sorry. Gene, why am I thinking Gene Stapleton? All in the family.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Maureen, let's just all get clear. Maureen Stapleton.
I believe Seattle wants to talk about Hetch Hetchy. Chuck?
No takers on the first one.
I think Chuck ought to handle that one.
I really do. Yeah. Seattle. Go for it.
He gets 100 inches of rain, he can handle it.
All right.
Just ship it all.
How about the second part of that question?
Terrorist.
The terrorist. Yeah, I got the corner on that one.
Homeland Security.
Yeah, the issue of Homeland Security, there's been a whole series of federal requirements we've all had to meet with respect to doing risk assessments and making improvements. And so almost I can't think of a major water utility that hasn't been dealing with this since September 11th and has had to make millions of dollars of investments. Our approach has been one using technology primarily. AWRF has been investing heavily in providing technology for utilities to use in lieu of some of the first initial approaches were, you know, hire 200 or 300 rent-a-cops and we'll have them walk around. But I think the water industry as a whole has done a remarkable job. There's also a ISAC program where we can, through a security network, share information with each other. So I think the water business has done an excellent job in responding.
Great. Maureen, you painted the great picture of a diversified portfolio. Is that in part to protect against those events as well?
It's more related to the hydrology issue, but I agree completely with Wally. The efforts that I think that the water agencies have made since September 11th have been remarkable, and that I think that we are one of the more secure utilities or areas as a result. Obviously, there is always the concern, but it doesn't mean just because you have a concern or a risk, you don't move ahead. What you have to do is analyze what that risk is, what the potential impacts are, and then make informed decisions. And I think that's what all of the agencies are doing, and certainly security is a piece of that risk assessment.
Are you folks in the Pacific Northwest looking at the Homeland Security issue any differently?
Well, we went from spending basically nothing in capital to $5 to $10 million a year on capital expenditures on security. Did do some early rent-a-cop stuff, particularly in-town reservoirs that were still uncovered, primarily for dealing with public confidence related to security issues. But I don't think anybody can give you any assurances. I mean, all you've done is you've done your best job at trying to look at where your vulnerabilities are. You've done the best job you can at trying to make reasonable investments of addressing those vulnerabilities through technology, through visibility, through a whole number of things. But at the end of the day, we can give you no more assurances than anybody else in the country can over what a dedicated person who wants to do something from a terrorist act perspective can do. I mean, it is the reality. I think we're all making the best judgments and best decisions we can on behalf of our ratepayers, and to be honest, none of us wants to be the one that's there having to deal with answering the questions if you haven't afterwards. So there's lots of energy in agencies to try to be rational about how they deal with it, but also make appropriate investments.
All right, other questions over here? Let's go right here in the middle.
Yes, I'm Joel Smith with Stratus Consulting. Assemblyman Member Huffman, you asked about the drought of record, whether it should be the 76-77 drought, and I'm impressed with what's being done to plan for long-term climate change we can foresee, sea level rise, rising temperatures. I'm wondering if any of you have wrestled with this question of how future droughts might change and in terms of incorporating climate scenarios or whatever you might be doing to see if future droughts might be worse and what you're doing to plan for that.
I'll just add that I think part of the answer, too, depends on whether you look at our relatively recent hydrologic records or whether you look at tree rings, because there are some pretty scary stories inside of those trees. But why don't we pass that to whoever wants to take it?
Let me start. I think we've been doing a pretty substantial job of diversifying with that in mind. I think the grant programs that Lester referred to, particularly the IRWMPs, have promoted in the Bay Area a whole system of interconnections. So if there's a drought on the American River, there may not be a drought on the Sacramento. We're diversifying with respect to supplies and ability. This also deals with the security issue asked. I think almost everything Maureen talked about it. Chuck, I got real resentment for Chuck with 100 inches up there, and he owns his whole watershed. But, I mean, everybody that talked here today, I think, is speaking specifically to what you said. This is not just looking down the road. In fact, if you think about what we are saying, which is you may look 40 years, but you're making the investments for today, and today are about what's going to happen with respect to the droughts that are right on the table in front of us. And the 76-77 scenario is probably just about in everybody's planning. And they look at it. The state has required the submittal every 5 years, the Urban Water Management Plan that has to look at that particular issue and how you're making your investments and dealing with it. So, yeah, it's not look long and forget about today.
I think part of the issue is we're more concerned about drought scenarios than we, from a Seattle perspective, than we are year-to-year water supply issues. Yeah. And the challenge for us is, and we've done some, actually had some discussions about tree ring work with University of Washington and looking at other scenarios, and also decadal shifts in temperature and whether we ought to be, you know, because typically people go back and look at 70 years of record or 100 years of record. That isn't going to get you where you need to go. And so the Australians have done a lot of work on trying to look at worst-case scenario planning, particularly related to back-to-back-to-back droughts, and they're now experiencing them. And so we've been working with them and trying to develop some very specific scenarios on drought that we're going to run, and then run some risk consequence models to see what kind of investment does that mean. You know, our problem is we get 100 years of rain, but if you don't have long-term supply because you've depended on it, then all of a sudden you are in a lot of trouble if you haven't really prepared to deal with the drought consequence issues.
Yeah, and from Portland's standpoint, we have the same situation. We're very supply limited. The study that we've done so far doesn't suggest that we would have more significant drought events, but that they would come with increasing frequency. And so that's the information we have at this point, but I think we would be interested in some of the directions that Chuck is suggesting in terms of trying to project something beyond our historic record, because it's very short.
All right, I think this may be the last question, but let's go to this side. Yes, down here.
Thank you. I'm Rock McKinley with Seawell Global. First, a question for Walter. Would you repeat the name of the book you showed to all of us?
It's called Climate Change and Water Resources, a Primer for Water Planners.
Thank you. The second comment is kind of takes off on Will's comments from the first seminar, and where's the leadership position. And what I haven't heard here in general is new water supplies. And the question I'm going to lead to is, if desalination is a direction for new water supplies, and we look at four major cost issues, as a subsea water production company and power energy company, our focus is to solve all the problems. And I think when Matt brought the question up, how do you resolve the environmental impact, not just the emissions issues, but what's the impact of brine input back in the ocean? Mm-hmm. What are the electrical costs, and where we're going to get electricity? Pipeline installation costs. So the bottom line comes, if there's a new opportunity out there, it's in a leadership position, who will be responsible in the state of California, the Department of Water Resources, municipalities to get the permittings to put pipelines in? Who's going to own the pipelines? Final question, what is the actual cost of water today, 2006 acre foot of water cost? And then we come forward with solutions.
And just to provide the context for that, do I understand that you're part of the deep sea desalination technology group, which, as I understand it, uses the osmotic pressure of a certain depth of the ocean to drive the reverse osmosis process without external energy? So a pretty fascinating technology, actually, and one that also raises the question that I'd like to just throw into the same mix. What happens when the energy demand line for desalination crosses our conventional sources today? So.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly the question. I mean, in terms of the question asked about who owns the pipelines, and I mean, to me that depends on where they are and who's being served by them. I mean, I think it's, mean, a lot of these kinds of investments, there may be a call. Like, obviously, the state has a long track record of saying there's a public benefit to investing in conservation and helping doing cost share and stuff. Less so when it comes to pipelines. That's looked at as whoever's benefiting at the end of that pipeline needs to pay for it, and I can't imagine that changing. You know, the energy issue is an interesting one, and that's why we actually have to start paying attention, not just the total energy for something like on desal, but what's the actual energy profile? When are you using the energy, and what's the source of that energy? So it's just a very different, obviously more complicated question now when you look at those trade-offs of, in Maureen's case, what's the energy profile of desal versus water that's being pumped over the Tehachapis? They're both using energies. What's the trade-off? What's the pattern look like? Where can you avoid peak? I mean, there's just a lot of issues in that, and it gets a lot more complicated.
Another issue is the technology. It's no secret that the cost using membranes has dropped while energy costs have gone up. AWARP just signed a partnership agreement with Singapore, has very advanced. They're an island that has to recycle everything with their membrane technology. And so our 900 subscribers are looking for the answers to the questions you're asking. And no, the one answer is desal is not the total solution for California's water supply in the future. That's why we talked about diversification, whether it be Maureen's case on the Colorado, desal, reclamation. Conjunctive use, which is one of our primary focuses in water transfers, is a way we're meeting it. So I happen to believe on the membrane, which is what you represent in desal, that technology is moving so quick with respect to smart membranes, advanced membranes, that we're not going to be asking a question that we're asking today with respect to membrane technology 5 to 10 years from now.
And one final piece is you talked about the cost of water, and I think that's one of the elements to be considered, but not the sole element to be considered in incremental water supply development. I think it goes back to the no silver bullet approach, which is there is not one single source or one single strategy that will work. It really is a compilation of all of the different tools that will ultimately help us be flexible and responsive to this changing environment.
All right. Well, on that note, our time is up. Please join me in thanking this excellent panel. And thanks to all of you.
SFGTV, San Francisco Government Television.